Sox Weekly. Your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Welcome to White Sox Weekly. Happy Saturday. Hope you're enjoying your weekend live from Wrigley Field as the White Sox are getting set for game number 2 of 3 in the midst of a 6-game homestand against the Cleveland Guardians here today. It is Bill Veeck night, so again, if you don't have any plans for this evening, come on out and join us at the ballpark. Nice, warm day. Perfect opportunity to sneak in a baseball game before the kids head back to school. Should be a fun day at the ballpark. Tough week for the White Sox, not going to lie. They came out of the All-Star break absolutely storming, thumping baseballs all over the ballpark. They continue to do that this week. Unfortunately, though, a little bit tough luck, and they now find themselves after going up against a couple of better teams in the American League in the Seattle Mariners and now Cleveland Guardians. They currently find themselves on a 5-game skid after opening up 10-4 to start the second half. And so now the White Sox are just 1 game above since the All-Star break, which means they've got some work to do if they're going to meet some of those lofty goals that I think they may have changed for White Sox folks out there. I personally, after the way they started the second half of the season, thought there was an opportunity to, you know, if you can carry through, maybe, just maybe, let's get crazy. Let's go for 500 in the second half. Maybe that's a little bit aggressive and ambitious, but professional baseball players, if you don't have any ambition, why are you in the ballgame? That was my hope. Unfortunately, this week has put a bit of a damper on it. Now, I'm not saying I don't think the White Sox haven't improved significantly since the All-Star break. If you've been watching, I do think they have made some fundamental changes, specifically in attacking the fastball and taking advantage of that as hitters, and they have seen immediate results as they are amongst the best in baseball when it comes to hitting home runs in the second half. At least they were coming into last night's game. They homered again last night. Didn't get a chance to check the most recent numbers, if the Phillies, how many they hit last night. So I don't know if the White Sox are still in first, but either way, they're still amongst the top 2 or 3 teams in baseball in home runs since the All-Star break. And that's a tangible difference when they were basically one of the worst hitting fastball teams in all of baseball in the first half of the season. And that was similar to where they were at last year as a team. They struggled, and I've talked to plenty of people inside the White Sox organization, and that was something that they harped on coming out of the All-Star break, was they needed to do a better job of dealing with the fastball and hitting it. And they have done that out of the gates here. Now, this week felt like a bit of a setback, and it started last Sunday, a day after the last White Sox weekly. The White Sox won a beautiful game, 1-0 on Saturday. Aaron Civale pitched really well. The bullpen also closed it down as the White Sox baffled the Los Angeles Angels and picked up the first 2 games of the road trip, and then had a huge opportunity to potentially sweep the Angels in Anaheim on Sunday afternoon, and they jumped out to an early 4-0 lead in the first. They added, courtesy mostly of a 3-run shot by Colson Montgomery, they added another to make it 5-0. And so it felt like the White Sox were just going to cruise to a sweep in Anaheim. Unfortunately, despite a pretty nice effort by Sean Burke in that ballgame, he was allowed to go into the 6th inning, and that's when the Angels actually got their hooks in him a little bit. They ended up putting 3 on him. So a nice outing by Sean Burke. Went a little bit sideways as they were leaning on him because he looked so good through the first 5. They thought they'd give him an opportunity to try and get through 6. And unfortunately, Angels were able to put some to score a run off of Burke and then bring home a couple of runs that he left when he left the ball game. And so at that point, it just felt like it was a little. That one was probably, for me, one of the more disappointing losses of the season. An opportunity to sweep. To be quite frank, one of the more disappointing losses by the White Sox in the last couple of seasons. A 5-0 lead with an opportunity to sweep. and you allow the Angels back into that ball game, and the Angels eventually tied it up with three runs in the sixth, two in the seventh to make it 5-5, and that gave Taylor Ward an opportunity in the bottom of the ninth to avoid the sweep for the Angels.
And Ward hits a towering fly deep left field. Benintendi back. He's at the fence. It's gone, and the Angels win it. Three-run homer for Taylor Ward. And they come all the way back to beat the White Sox 8-5.
Yes, indeed. So that one definitely stung for me because it felt like the White Sox, we were getting a little ridiculous, I'm not going to lie, for a team that is currently 32 games under 500 at 42-74. I think prior, in the midst of that 5-0 game, Brendan Riley, the executive producer of White Sox Baseball, and myself were having conversations about just had the White Sox turned a corner here. And I still feel really good about where they're at. I'm not going to go crazy, but that one really stung and hurt to blow a 5-0 lead when he had an opportunity for a sweep. White Sox then had a day off on Monday, and then they went out to the Emerald City to play the Seattle Mariners 4-3. And look, the Mariners are a really good baseball team. They have been all season, and they also went big at the trade deadline, adding Eugenio Suarez, and sure enough, the man who absolutely thrives against the White Sox. We'll get to him in a moment here. Or actually, no, let's get to him now. Josh Naylor. The moment the Mariners actually traded for him, we should have known it was going to be a problem for the White Sox because they still had three games remaining with the Mariners, and Josh Naylor wasted no time when he had the chance to take an at-bat against the Sox again, this time in Mariners blue.
Naylor punishes one in the air to right, and it's a home run, and he knew it. Two-run blow, and it's 8-1.
Yep. The minute he got traded and said, are the White Sox coming to town? Because I got some damage I have to do.
Yep. DJ knows it. Len knows it. Anybody who watches the White Sox knows that Josh Naylor absolutely feasts off of the White Sox. I went over his numbers extensively in a couple of postgame shows when the White Sox lost to the Mariners. He is essentially He's a Hall of Fame caliber player if you just look at the numbers he puts up against the White Sox. About a .340 batting average, just shy of .400 on base. He has 11 career home runs against the White Sox. 11 of his 98 career home runs are against the White Sox. And, you know, so that's more than 10% of his home runs come against the White Sox. He's absolutely absurd. He basically paces, if he played the White Sox 162 games, he would basically be a .340, .400, well over .500 slug, and then 30 homers, well over 100 RBIs, well over 100 runs scored. He's an absolute stud when he plays the White Sox. And he's a really good player, but for whatever reason, he absolutely loves playing the White Sox. There was some good news to come out of that 8-3 loss to the Mariners, and that was Luis Robert, who connected for his 100th career home run.
A swing and a shot deep to right, and it is gone off the railing just above the yellow line. Robert with a home run.
That was indeed his 100th career home run for the White Sox, and we'll get to a little bit of history here in a moment for Luis Robert. But we need to go to game number two against the Mariners, one that saw the Mariners prevail 8-6. And do I even need to tell you who was yet again a thorn in the White Sox side?
And he sends one deep to right for a home run. A two-run homer for Josh Naylor. And I didn't even get a chance to talk about what he did last night. 2-0 Seattle.
Boy, he hates the White Sox.
I beg to differ, DJ. I think he loves the White Sox. It is clear. And I will point it out. I know it's not necessarily a position that is highly prioritized in free agency, but Josh Naylor is a pending free agent. White Sox, while they have a lot of interesting players, they certainly, I think, have an opportunity, if they would like to splurge on a potential corner infield bat, We'll talk about Miguel Vargas, who hit the injured list with the oblique strain that he's dealing with. But we know that Vargas has the flexibility. He can man either third base or first base. But that should give the White Sox some flexibility, if they're in that market, to go out and add a potential big bat at either corner spot. And Josh Naylor could be a very interesting one. Lefty pop. Now, I think the one disappointing thing is, if you've watched Josh Naylor's entire career, and not just against the White Sox, I think he leads you wanting a little bit more pop from time to time. But nevertheless, it almost seems like if the White Sox could land him in free agency for whatever amount it would be well worth it just to get him not to have to face the White Sox anymore. Ah, I digress. But he hit his 14th home run in an 8-6 victory. Game number 2, the Mariners took that one. And then we moved to the series finale on Thursday. Bright spot for the White Sox came when Luis Robert made some history.
Long hold. Robert runs. Montgomery takes low, and Raleigh's not even going to throw it. And Luis Robert Jr. has his 100th career steal.
Yes, indeed. So that made Luis Robert Jr. a member of the 100-100 club in his career, making him just the fourth White Sox player to do so. In a White Sox uniform, he joined Mini Minoso, Ray Durham, and Alexei Ramirez. So Luis Robert Jr. in that list. Certainly, I personally am still happy to see him play in a White Sox uniform. We'll let you hear from Chris Getz here shortly, and he's happy to have Luis Robert still in a White Sox uniform. Chris Getz did take some criticism around the league, or at least there were some people who said that there was some frustration from other GMs about Chris Getz not being willing to move off of Luis Robert Jr. at the trade deadline. I'll tell you, and I said it, I think it was last week, if not 2 weeks ago, it's not Chris Getz's job to just give away Luis Robert Jr. If somebody really wanted Luis Robert Jr., they should have made a bona fide offer to make it difficult on Chris Getz and made him think, hey, this is a deal I can't pass up. It does sound like, though, that Luis Robert Jr., the White Sox, do have the team option on him for next season at $20 million. I think it's certainly a very realistic possibility that the White Sox will consider picking that up in the offseason, especially if he continues hitting the way he has in the second half here. It would almost feel like a no-brainer that you would pick it up if he continues to finish the season the way he has started the second half, and even a little bit prior to that. So it was good to see Louis pick up his 100th steal. The White Sox, though, did get swept in Seattle as they went to extras against the Mariners after trailing 2-0. They fought back to force extras. White Sox pushed across a run in the 10th. Mariners got their run, their ghost runner, in the 10th as well. Then the White Sox failed to score in the 11th, and that's when the Mariners were able to drive home the game-winning run in the 11th and finish off the sweep. And that meant the White Sox would fly across country back home to open up their homestand last night against the Cleveland Guardians. Again, another good baseball team. Guardians right now are 60-55 after last night's victory. And unfortunately, Aaron Civale, who pitched an absolute masterpiece against the Angels on the previous Saturday when he made his prior outing, this time around, he walked a couple of batters, had a hit-by-pitch in the first, and man, the Guardians were just blooping the ball in the absolute perfect spots last night. There was a 10-mile wind from the south that seemed to be playing havoc with some of the balls that were put in the air, but it just seemed like every time the Guardians made contact, it wasn't necessarily hard and solid contact. They just put them in the absolute perfect spots. They ended up having 3 doubles in the first inning when they had a big number, put up 5 on the White Sox. But of the 3 doubles, only one was an absolute, you know, rocket. CJ Cephas hit a missile off of the right field fence. But the other 2 doubles, Jose Ramirez's double and Carlos Santana's double, nothing special, just put in the absolute perfect spot. And sometimes that's just baseball. And if you're going to walk a couple of batters and also hit a batter in that same inning, it's going to be problematic. That gave the Guardians 5 runs. And basically that was really what they needed. Now the White Sox actually did fight their way back in this one, which was fun to see. It started with a Brooks Baldwin home run.
Swing and a drive out into right, and it will go. Brooks Baldwin gets the White Sox on the board with a solo homer, and it's now 6-1.
So that came in the bottom of the third, and the White Sox did their best to make it a ball game. But I will say the Guardians put up three more in the fourth, which kind of pushed it out to a spot where it seemed very unrealistic for the White Sox to make a comeback. That didn't mean they didn't try, as they put nine batters to the plate in the bottom of the sixth as they tried to make that valiant comeback. It started with a Corey Jolks double. Corey Jolks actually, now this is interesting because it was 9-1, so Will Venable chose to remove Lenin Sosa and Luis Robert from the ballgame just to get them off their legs and a little bit of rest in the blowout, or what seemed like it was a blowout. So Corey Jolks came on, and when he had an opportunity to take his first at bat in the sixth, he led off with a double. And then Jacob Amaya actually walked. Colson Montgomery walked. Curtis Meade singled home a couple. Kyle Teal reached base on an error by Brian Rocchio. Michael Taylor walked. Now, bases loaded. The White Sox had already driven in three in that inning. And Brooks Baldwin pops up to the catcher, which really felt like a moment missed. But there was still an opportunity for Mike Tauchman to play the role of hero. It was 9-4 with the bases loaded. So had he connected on a grand slam, this place would have erupted and the White Sox would have been within one with three innings to go. Unfortunately, that's when this occurred.
1-2 pitch. Check swing. He went on a low sweeper, and Tauchman slams his helmet down, and he just got kicked out of the game.
He did indeed, as the third base umpire and crew chief Andy Fletcher tossed Tauchman when he was very upset about the call on the check swing, and that ended the threat for the White Sox. And really, it was a potential big inning there, and it was a huge moment in the ballgame. And what are you going to do? That's just what's going to happen when you find yourself trailing by five runs in a big spot there. And so the White Sox fall to the Guardians. They drop the opener of their homestand, and now they've got two more against the Guardians here on Saturday and Sunday before the Tigers come to town on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So some AL Central showdowns here at Rate Field over the next few days. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly, and this is your recap of the week that was. Coming up next, I'll let you hear from White Sox general manager Chris Getz, who met the media yesterday. There are still a lot of things to be encouraged about, I will say that. The White Sox continue to hit the ball at a much better rate than they were at any point in the last couple of seasons, and it certainly seems like if they can keep using what they've been harped on to do with the fastball, if they can keep making that a priority and keep having success, you wonder, could this be something that's sustainable for the long haul? All of a sudden, this lineup that's filled with a lot of good, young, exciting players is very interesting. So Chris Getz will address a lot of that coming up here in just a moment. Sox fans, join us at the ballpark tomorrow, August 10th, as the White Sox take on the Cleveland Guardians at 110. The first 7,500 fans in attendance will receive a Southside legend, Ozzie Guillen bobblehead, presented by United, Chicago's hometown airline. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, we'll let you hear from Chris Getz right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Yeah, just, you know, we felt like it was a good time to give him a breather. He'd been fighting himself a little bit, searching, you know, so we view it as an opportunity to get his confidence back. You know, he's a guy that needs to attack the zone. You know, he's got an ability to get quick early contact and kind of got away from that approach, and pitch counts were getting high and he wasn't as productive. So we've got some things to work on, you know, and he's not the first guy to have been optioned. You know, he's still very early in his career, and we believe in him. We've seen, you know, an extended period of time of being a successful starter. So, he's go down there and get to work, and I'm sure he'll be back here, you know, before he knows it.
I think people assume because it's a rebuild that, oh, you can let him struggle, you can lose, and that kind of thing. But you guys have been very proactive this year about taking guys who you've given chance to kind of write things and maybe giving them a little break to come back there and then find their way.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, there's develop opportunities, you know, throughout a season, and, you know, Colson obviously gets a lot of attention for going to Arizona and then, you know, getting back to Charlotte and doing what he's doing, and that's obviously worked out very well for him, considering how productive he's been at the major league level. And in a way, it's a chance for Jonathan to take a deep breath and then find yourself. I think, you know, when it's really hard at the major league level when you start searching. And so when you go down to AAA, the game slows down. You know, it's a different pace to it. And oftentimes you can just kind of lose yourself, you know, at the major league level, where you go back down there, oh, this is what I can do. You know, I can land this pitch and attack hitters this way. And so, you know, I hope he views it as an opportunity. I know he was disappointed, but he understood. And we still believe in him, of course, and just like we believe in, you know, so many of our players. And that's why we made the move that we did, because we know that there's a better version of Jonathan Cannon than what we've seen here recently.
Is there a physical element to it, you know, coming off the back injury, anything mechanically could be off, or, you know, his velocity being a little bit down from last year? Is there a physical element to it?
Yeah, I mean, he's been fighting his delivery. He has. Now, how related is that to his back injury? I don't. You know, he is healthy. He says he's healthy. You look at the strength testing, the mobility when he's with the trainers and strength coaches. So, but you know, it's when it comes to pitching, you can have an idea of where you want to take the ball, but if your body's not getting in line to do that, you're going to have your struggles. So, once again, I think just getting him in an environment that he can slow down a little bit, find himself, have some really quality side sessions. You know, not so reliant on immediate results, because when you're at the major league level, you want to produce right away, and where, you know, we can get to work and once again just continue to build him back up.
You guys have several options for the rotation spot. You have Vassell, Alexander, Martin Perez is on rehab. Do you have a place you're leaning?
Right now, you know, it lines up for Alexander, considering he came in after Jonathan was removed from the game. He's fairly stretched out. He started before in the big leagues. He's been throwing well. So that's a kind of a seamless option right there. And then, yeah, Martin's starting tonight in Birmingham, and we'll build him back up. He feels good, and we know what he's capable of doing at the major league level. He's done it for so long. So it's never a problem to have too many options, and we're going to continue to build that depth and prepare guys to step up when an opportunity arises.
How many rehab starts do you want to see Martin get to build himself back up to where you want?
Well, he'll be in Birmingham, then he'll go to Charlotte, and then we'll kind of assess from there. So we don't have, you know, just a definite number set in mind. We want to make sure that he feels good, feels confident. Of course, he's productive, and we'll make the decision from there.
Had an opportunity to see some of the new guys in action, starting with Curtis. Just early impressions of what you've seen from him so far.
Curtis has done a nice job, getting some big hits, quality at bats. You know, he's been productive, and look forward to the opportunity to move him around the diamond a little bit. He's got history at second base and third base. His defense really got better this year. Looking at the metrics and talking to people with Tampa Bay, obviously he's filled in at first base because there's been a need there. So, you know, we'll move him around the diamond, but, you know, he looks to be getting comfortable in the box here in a White Sox uniform, and, you know, look forward to watching him tonight.
Chris, you seem to have put together a good group of young talent here through various, you know, trades, you know, whatever, draft and everything else. How tough is it to build that good team, which is the next step? Like, you saw that when 05 came back 3-9. They had a lot of good players, but they had a really good team. Is that kind of something you focus on, like trying to find the fit for everyone and trying to find the best way that it works?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to go about roster construction. Now, I will say it's been about, you know, adding quality pieces that we feel like could be impactful major league players. And, you know, there's a development piece to that, both at the major league and minor league level. You want to add as much talent as you can. You want to build as much depth as you can, because we know that there's going to be injuries from time to time. We know that there's going to be maybe a lack of production and a guy needs to go back to the minor leagues, and you want to be able to fill that with a quality player. And I think that's, you look around the league at the teams that are at the top continuously, it's because they have the depth and not just a 26-man roster. It's got to be much deeper than that. And so, you know, in this rebuild, it's about acquiring the talent however you can and continue to develop those guys and, you know, create as many options as you can.
What's kind of the outlook for Chase and Miguel? What kind of injury absence are you looking for with him?
Yeah, so they're progressing very well. You know, Chase, you know, being the hitter that he is, he's very handsy. That top hand, you know, is such a big part of his offensive game. It really sets his direction. And when you have inflammation in there, it can, you know, you want to avoid any bad habits. So we just wanted to zap that eliminate any sort of irritation. And, you know, he's going to start swinging the bat here this weekend at some point, and Miguel's not too far behind him. He's been running around doing sprints. You know, he's moving in the right direction. And, you know, I think before we know it, these guys are going to be back. So they are progressing well.
Keeping Robert obviously was an important move for the organization, and a lot of controversy whether he should, you know, you should cut bait. Does it show that you're going to pick up the option and then that he's part of the team next year, or is there still some uncertainty there?
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't cut bait, considering, you know, how productive he's been. You look at, you know, how good he's been since the All-Star break. I think he's hitting about 400 and one of the top players in the league. And then you obviously, not only offensively, but defensively. And he got the 30 stolen bases. And I know for his career, he's got 100 home runs now and 100 stolen bases. So that just speaks to the talent that he still has. And we feel like he's left in the tank. We feel like he's part of this team. We're excited about having Louis Robert in the White Sox organization. And you know, it's exciting to watch him go out there and play. You know, he really can impact in different ways. Where when he's playing well, the team is seemingly playing well, and we're getting wins. So, yeah, he's a guy that we like having in this organization, and we're planning on having him, you know, part of the future.
Does that decision kind of speak to what you think could be possible for this team moving forward in the next year? Also, the way they've been playing since the All-Star break, you know, the collection of young guys, not just what you'd see on a stat line from Louis specifically?
Sure. I mean, I've said this from the beginning. I really wanted to create an environment and a team that's strong up the middle. We've got two young catchers that I would say, you know, you look at that tandem, youth and their ability, and that's something that's really special. And then you got Colson, you got Chase. We've got other players in the wings up the middle that are going to help strengthen that group. And then Louis Robert in center field. So, you know, when you're strong up the middle, you're in a good position to win baseball games. And, you know, we'll continue to add around those players, and we've got plenty of guys that are stepping up and playing well, and we're going to continue to add to this group.
What's impressed you the most about Brayden Montgomery this year? I know he's had another stop in Birmingham, and along that side, on how much stock do you put into a team like that that's winning, you know, I think they're like 23-4 at one point in a stretch there. I mean, you obviously like that better than 4-23, but do you just like the way they've kind of played together? But I guess Brayden first, what you've seen out of him.
Yeah, Brayden's had a solid first season. You know, he got off to such a great start in Winston-Salem, and I know he was itching to get to Double-A, and we finally were able to get him there at an appropriate pace, and he's continuing to be productive. You know, you look at, you know, his left-handed swing and right-handed swing, they're both, you know, they both can be impactful, and what a weapon to have a switch hitter. The defensively, you know, he's playing all three spots. He's graded out really well in the wings. He's done a solid job in center field. So we feel really good about where Brayden is and where we feel like it's going to go. And then you look at that Birmingham team and what they've been able to do is incredible. You know, Q's done a great job with that club. And, you know, you look at some of the pitchers that we have, whether it be, you know, Hagen, Tanner McDougal, some of the bullpen arms, and then an offense in Bergoglio. And obviously Brayden's down there too, and you know, on a regular basis they're finding ways to win ball games, and winning is part of the development at the minor league level. So, you know, to have that environment for players to show up every day knowing they have a chance to win is really a positive. And hats off to those guys, because it's been fun watching them on a nightly basis bring home W's.
Hey Chris, did you bring Martin Perez to Birmingham because of the schedule, or did you actually want him playing with those guys? What was behind
him? Well, Martin is an asset with any club, I will say, just because of the, you know, his experience, his intelligence, his willingness to share. I will say it wasn't part of the calculation because we were winning ball games. Let's add Martin Perez to that. That would be. I'm not saying that's out of, you know, out of the equation sometimes when you're, you know, trying to win at the minor league level, but most importantly, we're just trying to get him healthy, and we look forward to having a productive night.
I'm talking about for the young guys, not for you guys to win more games in Birmingham.
Well, it's about winning, Chuck. I mean, come on. You know, so it is beneficial having him down there, and a lot of that has to do with you know, the maturity and the intelligence and his experience. So, you know, I know that there's going to be a benefit having him around. But most importantly, let's get Martin Perez going.
That was Chris Getz yesterday. Still more from him we'll let you hear in a moment, but let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves. The Barons, unfortunately, did lose yesterday, by the way, so they're still crushing it, but they did take a loss yesterday. Hey, join us at the Ballpark Family Sundays presented by Coca-Cola. The first 125 kids to enter at Gate 5 will head to a special area to receive autographs from some of their favorite players, plus enjoy family-friendly activities. Kids can run the bases and more. Tickets are just $10. That includes all fees. To learn more, purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sunday. When we come back, we'll let you hear the rest from Chris Getz right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back at Wright Field on White Sox Weekly as we get set for game number 2 of 3 between the Sox and Guardians. We'll let you hear from Chris Getz here in a moment. Sox fans head to the ballpark Monday, August 11th, as the Sox take on the Detroit Tigers at 6:40 for Pokemon Go Nights. Receive a limited edition co-branded Pokemon Go t-shirt when you purchase a specially priced ticket. Limited availability to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/promos. Here's some more from Chris Getz. He was asked for an update regarding Noah Schultz.
Do you have any further update on Noah Schultz? How's he progressing? How's he doing?
He's progressing well. You know, that soreness seems to be very minimal at this point. Obviously, that front knee is such a big piece of what a pitcher can do in terms of both velocity and location. Noah is going to be going to the Fall League, and so we're excited to have him part of it. Hagen's going there as well. And we've got a pretty solid group this year. So, they unfortunately Noah and Hagen have missed some time. So we're going to continue their development season in the Fall League and look forward to watching that play out.
You guys have been dramatically better offensively since the All-Star break. What, in your mind, is the reason for the increase in production?
I think it starts with the fastball. You know, Will's talked about it. Obviously, I've talked to the staff at length about prioritizing getting on time and driving the fastball, and that's really opened, our offense up. So, credit to Will, the staff, but the most credit, most deserving credit are the players. They've really answered the bell and has allowed us to put up more runs.
You guys have homered in 15 of the last 16 games. I mean, you knew the talent was there, but did you know the power was there in this lineup?
We knew it was in there. unfortunately, it had been dormant, and it still goes back to the fastball. And if you're going to put up power numbers, you got to be able to be productive on fastballs, and they've shown they've been able to do that. And hitting such a delicate thing, it comes, it goes. So I look forward to seeing this ride out, hopefully for a while.
As you look at what Colson has been able to do, is there something to the fact that he's just in the big leagues now and he doesn't have to worry about getting to the big leagues? Is there anything to that?
I think there's an element to that. You get players that get so much prospect attention. They're at the top of the rankings, and almost, especially when it happens earlier in their career, and you're talking about a high school player that timeline's going to be a little bit different perhaps than maybe a college player, and maintaining that status is a difficult thing. And then once you're kind of knocking on the door and you're trying to get over the hump and just break into the major leagues, there's an added element of stress that comes with that. And so I do believe that him coming up here just has freed him up and allowed him to be the player that we knew he could be. And then I guess you got to give some credit to the torpedo bat, considering how often that's been getting attention throughout the league. And it looks like he's a beneficiary of it as well. But Colson's done a really nice job on the defensive side, both at shortstop and third base, in which he hasn't played a ton of third. He looks very comfortable over there, most importantly. But in the box, he's a threat at the plate. He's trying to do damage. It's really exciting for the organization. And I'm sure Colson is just as excited to be able to be a productive major league player.
Has Colson gotten a fresh supply of a new torpedo bat? I know he broke the one the other day. He said he had to order some.
Gosh, I hope so. And if he didn't, I'll put the order in, for him quickly.
Yeah, for him maybe.
Yeah, that's right. So I haven't checked in on that, but it's definitely
worth probably checking in on.
Lenin Sosa being especially productive at the plate lately, are you seeing anything maybe different with him, or what do you think has allowed him to kind of take the next step compared to, maybe previous seasons?
Yeah, I mean, he's just getting more confident in the box. You know, he has made some adjustments to put himself in a position to drive the baseball and be consistent at the plate. We were just talking as a staff. Can't remember the date, but it's been a while now, and he's a player that has definitely accrued a fair amount of wins for our club. And you look at his individual production; it's been really solid. It takes a minute for some young players to really find themselves, and it looks like he's really tapped into something, and it's exciting to see.
What part has Will played in kind of creating the environment in which this success can happen? Obviously, people can look at the numbers of what's occurred since the All-Star break, but behind the scenes, what has Will been doing?
He deserves a lot of credit. You know, his communication style, his consistency. You know, every series, every day, he creates a pathway to victory. So it's really, fine-tune a purpose for our players to go out there and perform, and not necessarily just focused on themselves and their own production, but going out there to win a baseball game. And it's begun to play out. There are no highs and lows with him. And in this game, when you're playing 162-game season, consistency is so valuable from in a leadership role like the manager. And, that was one of the biggest reasons why we targeted Will, and very fortunate to be able to convert and bring him in here, because I knew that he was just going to be such a steady, respected, leader in this clubhouse. And we're starting to see some really positive results. And sometimes it doesn't happen overnight, but we're in a period where we're getting some wins and we're feeling good and the vibes are solid. Guys are excited to show up, and they know they have a chance to win every night.
What do you have to do going into the off season to know that, okay, we turn the corner, maybe we can make some additions free agent-wise and that kind of thinking, or is that too soon to think about?
It's too soon. I mean, we've got, essentially 2 months of baseball left, and, a lot of these players are getting through their first full seasons. At the major league level, some of them first full season in a White Sox uniform, and we're getting a pretty good idea of what they're capable of doing, but in regards to shaping the roster, I think we need a little bit more time, but we're definitely going to look for opportunities to add to this club.
Do you feel like you've turned a corner, if not the corner, at least in the last few weeks or months?
I'd say in a corner. We're not there yet. We've got a lot of work ahead of us. Most importantly, we're playing well right now, and we're going to look for different ways to add to this club and find ways to beat our opponent. But the work doesn't stop. It doesn't, and we're going to look for chances to add to this club in different ways. Get creative at times in terms of strategy. We're certainly not there yet, but, we feel like we're heading in the right direction.
Following up on the need, you've been watching for a very long time. I think we both have. But are there things about his development that surprised you, like, from his origins when he was kind of a contact hitter to the kind of offensive player he is now, where it's not traditional, he's very aggressive, but obviously he's found a way to be productive?
Well, he's always had contact ability, and he's really added some strength. I think he's just got a greater understanding of who he is. When we were around him at 17 years old, I mean, it was there were always a lot of positives. You could tell he was a guy that was looking forward to getting to the box. That's a good sign. Not everyone has that trait about them. But we've always believed in the player, and most importantly, he's believed in himself. And he's getting a chance to play on a regular basis, and he's taking advantage of it.
Because you guys use Teal and Caro in the lineup frequently together, would you ever consider carrying a third catcher?
We've had those discussions before. It's something we'll probably do at some point. I don't know if that's a long-term solution, considering what it does to your bench. Will and the staff, they at times they've liked using the DH position with the catcher, whether it be Q or Teal. It can get a little risky, because of certain happenings in a game, and all of a sudden, you thin out, you don't have that flexibility, but I, You know, I don't think it's one thing that you just make a definite decision that you're going to carry your third catcher. I think there will be moments that we do that, but we've had plenty of those conversations.
You found this to be having two catchers, is it more of like happenstance, or has it been beneficial in terms of, you know, their workload or their development? Like, would you do this again if you could enter into the situation, I guess?
Well, you know, one thing that I don't think it gets enough value or enough credit is how challenging the role is and how taxing it can be on a player physically. And you're looking at two players that are in the big leagues for the first time. So to be able to balance the workload and keep these guys fresh, but also work on certain pieces of their game and their skill development to improve, you know, their ability to be a longstanding fit at the major league level. So, you know, I've always valued the position greatly. I think it's just got such an impact on the game for a lot of different reasons. I think we've all enjoyed having two quality catchers. We, you know, oftentimes you've got one catcher, and then when he has a day off, you know, you feel like you may have a hole in the lineup or a catcher that might not be as quality in regards to calling games or receiving. And to have two solid guys is definitely a benefit to the White Sox, and we enjoy having those two guys.
That was Chris Getz as he met the media yesterday at the start of the White Sox homestand against the Guardians yesterday afternoon. Speaking of two catchers in the lineup at the same time, that is the case today. Lenin Sosa leads off at second base. Edgar Caro will do the catching and hit second. Luis Robert Jr. hits third, playing center field. Curtis Meade will play first base and clean up. Kyle Teal will DH today and hit fifth. Batting sixth, it will be Michael A. Taylor in right field. Corey Jolks gets the start in left field. He'll hit seventh. Jacob Amaya mans shortstop and hits eighth. And Brooks Baldwin rounds out the lineup and plays third base. So there you go. Teal and Caro both in the starting lineup again today. Sox fans, save all summer long with our summer savings section. Enjoy $20 weekday and $25 weekend select lower level tickets while supplies last. The summer savings section is presented by Wintrust. Different approach, better results. Includes fees. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/section. Coming up next, Connor McKnight is in for Darren Jackson tonight on the play-by-play call with Len Casper. He'll join me next right here on White Sox Weekly. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network, live at Rate Field as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Guardians. Sox trying to snap a 5-game skid despite looking much better in the second half of the season. And it is my pleasure to be joined by the man who will be calling the game tonight with Len Casper in for Darren Jackson. It is Connor McKnight. Connor, I'm sorry, I don't have any wings to make you feel a little bit more at home. I have to ask the, because I looked up, I peeked up by the corner of my eye, and I saw you with a full plate of wings last night on the CHSN All Access broadcast. First and foremost, before we get to the wings, how did the broadcast go?
Broadcast was great. Always good to see Sean Evans of Hot Ones. Yes. He and I go way back.
So there was a reason. Connor, didn't you say, bring me all the wings?
No, bring me all the finest meats and cheeses. I mean, that's how I arrived at the ballpark every morning, but this one was a little bit different. Yeah, Sean was in town. Diehard White Sox fan. Guy who's been following this team since the moment he was born. His dad was a Sox fan. Sean and I go way back, so, you know, thrilled for his success, and he's been a, you know, multinational success story for years now. But, you know, every time he comes back in town, we manage to hook up here at the ballpark and say hello. He hasn't brought the hot sauce before, and this time he did.
Yes.
And I wish he hadn't, if we're going to be real honest about things. But Chris Withers, our producer on the TV side, said, you know, listen, this is the time to do a bit. This is the time to put it together. And we did. So the hot sauce was it says 6 out of 10 on the label.
Oh, boy.
Which is hot. It was a 69,000 on the Scoville scale.
Nice.
And as I understand, like, that's an exponential thing. Yeah. Like, it doesn't, you know,
like
just
an actual scientific method for hotness.
From what I understand. I didn't want to look that up beforehand.
Good call.
I looked it up afterward. 69K is not, like, it is not inconsequential. It is also, I'm not saying that I ate a ghost pepper or anything like
that.
I didn't, you know, but it lingered, Jeff.
I'm sure.
It lingered, and I'm glad to be back in action for the most part today.
How did you Did you go with? Did you have milk on standby? Water? How
we
did that?
So Sheena Quinn and everybody with the ballpark operations staff and Rich we had the campfire milkshakes.
Yes.
Both of us. I drank mine. I drank Sean's. There was a glass of milk. Someone had told me that bread was a good way to kill
alleviate
the heat
or whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I asked, you know, here in the barge room where we get, you know, the meals beforehand, I asked for two extra hamburger buns.
There you go.
And the woman serving that day was like, are you well? And I said, no, I'm not. I'm doing hot ones with Sean Evans. She's like, oh my God, what else do you need? Like,
yeah.
Genuine worry. Tori and Julia, who work the sweet staff up on four, helped get me the milk because they found out that I was doing this insane thing, and that was very helpful. But I'll tell you what, there's every reason to come out to the ballpark and just try the campfire milkshake because it's fantastic.
Oh, of course.
But if you drink one in less than 6 seconds, it creates its own
lactose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I drank a campfire milkshake in less than 6 seconds because I was trying to put the heat down, and it was quite a day.
Nice. Nice. Well, I didn't get to the full – I didn't have audio because obviously we were hanging out with Len, I saw visually it looked entertaining, so I figured I would ask. Connor McKnight joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Of course, you're familiar with his voice. He did – before moving on to become a big TV star with CHSN, he held this role before I did, so we're happy to have him. And, of course, he'll be in for DJ tonight. All right, so, Connor, they're on a bit of a skid right now, the White Sox, five in a row. But, man, offensively, that even looks like they are a different ball club in the second half of the season. Everybody around the White Sox front office and even in the, you know, the coaching staff, they haven't hit it. They're doing much better with the fastball. Is it sustainable?
Yeah, I think it is. But like many things in this game, the adjustment's coming, right? Whether it's Colson Montgomery, who saw a whole lot of spin against the Mariners, a lot of back foot sliders, or, you know, anybody else up and down the lineup. Yeah, they're going to adjust to this White Sox team. They've got to be able to adjust back. Now, that's where it's really interesting, I think, with this offense, because all in the first three and a half months, Jeff, as you well know, and you've been talking about a ton on the show and on pre and post, this has been a plate control team, a team that does not chase much and has really good numbers when it comes to remaining disciplined inside the strike zone. So if you do go to more spin, the opposing pitching staff, slider slowing in or high and away, whatever, then you go, okay, well, that's not something that they've chased before. Mm-hmm. Setting up for the fastball and getting geared up to go does expose you to some things on the outside edges, no doubt about it. But when your bedrock is don't chase stuff outside the zone, I think it'll be really interesting to watch this team and how, you know, backstopped they are against that next adjustment. I think what's also been really interesting, you know, you mentioned the five losses in a row. You know this. You get the other broadcast comes in from out of town. And everybody chats before the first game of a series, catching up. Hey, what do I need to know about this guy? What do you hear? All this kind of stuff. And, you know, by and large, for the last couple of weeks, especially since the All-Star break, you talk to Len, talk to DJ, other broadcasts are coming in going, hey, you guys don't look anything like you did 2 months ago. This is a really interesting ball club. And there's not smoke there. And I think, too, like, yeah, sure, they've lost five in a row. But I think White Sox fans who have lived and died with this team for a few years would be very quick to say, maybe reluctant to offer it because you want the W's. I get that. But these five losses look nothing like five losses back in May and nothing like five straight losses a year ago. Like, it's completely different.
Well, you look up and down the lineup, and obviously injuries for Mydroth and Vargas keep them out. But for the most part, to your point, it's filled with young, exciting players that are proving for the most part that, at the very least, they're all competent major leaguers with a lot more coming, it feels like. So that's the exciting part about watching a young baseball team as they try and find their groove. So, yeah, I'm completely with you. And, hey, listen, you know, they took advantage in the first part of the second half of the season here with the schedule a little bit, the Pirates. I mean, the Rays are a good ball club, but the Mariners are, with the additions of Suarez and the Sox killer of all Sox killers, Josh Naylor. You know, that lineup is one, I think, the best in the American League going right now.
It's really well-rounded. I think Josh Naylor gets, rightly so, Josh Naylor gets a lot of heat from opposing fan bases because of who he is. Mm-hmm. And also, and rightly so, he's a really good player. I mean, he's upped his stolen base percentage. He's taken off like crazy with the Mariners. I did the math. I texted the boys chat the other night with Waddle and Sylvie and Carm and everybody else. Josh Naylor has been more, and I just did a quick, I did, like, I don't know the math for wins above replacement, but I went to a website
that does a
simple war calculator, simple wins above replacement calculator. In his career, if you assume okay defense at first from Naylor,
yes,
in his games against the White Sox, he's been worth about 2 wins above replacement. The going rate for a win above replacement on the free agent market,
yes,
is about $8 million.
Yes.
That means he's put up $16 million of value in 54 games,
correct,
against the White Sox in,
yes,
his career. That is, like, we should run the numbers. That might be the White Sox killer of all White Sox killers in the last 40 years of baseball.
It's insane.
It's wild.
Yeah, and just, you know, that's a great breakdown for the more simple fans out there. He has 11 of his 98 career home runs against the White Sox. So more than 10% of his career home runs have come against the White Sox in far less than 10% of his games. It is absurd. It is crazy. And I think we can continue to make, or I can continue to make the argument that first base is not a, you know, a priority in free agency. You like, in this day and age in baseball, you like to keep that flexibility. You don't want to pay for somebody who is not going to help you necessarily defensively. But you can make the argument that the White Sox might just be better off signing him for whatever it takes just to keep him from hitting against them.
It's worth it. Yeah. I mean, it's, listen, the math speaks for itself. I'm not saying you and I are either mathematicians, but yeah, the math speaks for itself. He's worth 16 to not play for you for the next 53 games, that's for sure. I think, too, you know, the other thing about the White Sox, as you mentioned, and I think it'll be, man, I think this winter is going to be really fun. I can't wait to be, you know, here on White Sox Weekly a time or two this winter. That's,
yes,
me inviting
or three
myself.
Or four or six.
Man, you know, there could be a couple creative things they get up to. Whether it's going to be in free agency or moving a couple of players that you may not expect them to move in order to bring in some pieces that help shore up some areas. And I'm not talking about immediately on the 26-man roster.
Yeah.
But shore up some places, specifically offensively, where the White Sox could use some more depth up and down the system. It's going to be fascinating because over these next 2 months,
yes,
end of August and into September here, I think we're going to learn a little bit more about each individual fella. And take, for instance, Lenin Sosa, right? Mm-hmm. Dude's on a heater. Did you think that Lenin Sosa had this in him?
No.
Because I didn't.
No.
And I'll be first to say it. I observe the Leninites online. I understand that it is an avid fan base, replete with White Sox fans, who very much root for Sosa in all of his vagaries. But he doesn't really have a defensive home. It's going to be tough for him to crack this lineup,
yeah,
again next year unless he's hitting like he is now. What am I bid? You know, I mean, maybe that's something where the White Sox, yeah, can make, you know, a little bit more hay in other places.
Yeah, listen, his bat, yeah, it's been surprising to say the least. Defensively, he still puts you in compromising positions where,
yeah,
you oftentimes, you know, I think he's honestly, you know, any time at this point when he goes out and is actually slated, I don't know if he's going to get first base again, to be honest with you, the way it's gone, but he seems to make a defensive miscue every time he's playing out there in the field. But yeah, offensively, when he can do what he's doing, it's hard to overlook that.
Mm-hmm.
How about, what are your thoughts more specifically? I asked Chris Getz yesterday about the, you know, the Caro Teal combination here.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask him specifically about it, but I'm curious your thoughts, because I don't know if I would have gotten an honest answer from Chris Getz. Is there a scenario where going forward you could legitimately see them playing Caro and Teal about 80 games apiece and maybe DHing one of them, I don't know, 40 times a year?
I think so, yeah. I think that's, I mean, this is what I've heard. They've been consistent with that messaging publicly, so I think that matters quite a bit. I'll tell you what, when we found out Caro was coming up, pardon, when we found out Teal was coming,
yeah,
up, because Caro came up first and then it was Kyle Teal, I was an advocate just in my own head and kind of out loud, thinking out loud, like, I wouldn't mind seeing a three-catcher roster. At the time, you had Corey Lee, who's pretty athletic. You know, so in terms of base running, you've,
yeah,
got an active threat. I'm not saying stealing bases, but going first to third. He's not your typical plotting catcher, right?
Yep.
You had Kyle Teal, who's got a lot of athleticism, and Edgar Caro. You know, no, he's not a swift base runner or anything like that, but he can absolutely hold his own. And I think there was an opportunity to do that, knowing that you could put both of those young players in the lineup, have your backup catcher as well, and not run into a situation like the White Sox did in Texas, where you've got a pitcher hitting for himself. Now, I don't criticize that spot.
Yeah.
They made the moves they had to make to get that game to a point where Tyler Alexander was hitting for himself. However, we're going to get to September here, Jeff. White Sox are going to add another pitcher, add another hitter. I would love to see it be a third catcher so that they are completely, here's a terrible pun, backstopped against having both backstops in the lineup and having another one for you on the bench. I want them to feel real free to play Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal every damn day in September if the legs are going to let them do it.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, this it's easy, I think, for because I asked Chris Getz specifically yesterday about carrying a third catcher, and he said he admitted they've had conversations about it, but ultimately, and I get it, like you don't necessarily want to compromise your entire roster, especially, hey, Mike Tauchman, Andrew Benintendi, you know they're going to need a day or two to DH a piece themselves.
They're getting them today. They're getting days off today, both of them.
Oh, and but even still, like you're going to want them in the lineup and one of them DHing more times than not. So
no
I completely understand not doing it this year, but I also wonder to your point about Texas, right? That's an easy game to overlook a little bit in a season where you're 32 games under 500. If we get to the point where the White Sox are in a much more competitive race, then those games are much harder to overlook. And so that's why I just wonder, ultimately, long-term, how this roster will be constructed going forward. Maybe, you know, maybe it'll be easier to in spring training to allow Kyle Teal to maybe play a little bit more first base from time to time or a corner outfield spot.
I think that's an interesting point too, Jeff. And I don't think I would be very against doing that, adding a third position, counting catcher and DH, right, as two different spots. I would be very reluctant, if not completely against adding a third position to either one of these guys in their rookie season. Catching is way too hard to mix that in for anybody. But yeah, I think given Kyle's athleticism specifically, not that Caro couldn't play first, but I think you've got those options out there for Kyle. And while I don't think it would be 20 games, even 15 helps you open up a lot of other possibilities and keep out of those rare instances like you're talking about, because instead of lifting that guy to pinch run, he's moving out to the outfield or out to first base. Then your catcher, your backup catcher gets into the ball game and you're not hitting a reliever for himself.
Connor, great stuff. Appreciate you stopping by. You will be on the call with Len Casper this evening and for Darren Jackson. Can't wait to hear you guys together. Thanks for popping by, man.
Anytime. Anytime, you know that. Don't eat the hot wings. It's not a good idea.
All right. He is Connor McKnight. He will be on the broadcast with Len tonight. Hey, Sox fans, head to the ballpark on Friday, August 22nd for Elvis Night, presented by Beggar's Pizza, as the White Sox take on the Minnesota Twins at 6:40. Be sure to stay after the game for a post-game fireworks show presented by Beggar's Pizza. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, I will get you the lineup and also giving you a broadcasting note regarding tomorrow as well, right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back at Wright Field as the White Sox host the Guardians today. Game number 2 of 3 between the two after the Sox dropped the opener last night. Sox lineup for you. Lenine Sosa, as we were talking about with Connor just a moment ago, he's going to lead off and play second base. Edgar Caro hits second. The switch-hitting catcher hits second. Luis Robert Jr. in center field batting third. Curtis Meade cleans up and plays first base. Kyle Teal, lefty DH, hits fifth tonight. Michael A. Taylor batting sixth and playing right field. Corey Jolks will get the start in left field and hit seventh. Jacob Amaya, man, shortstop and bats eighth. And Brooks Baldwin will play third base and round out the lineup for the White Sox this evening. Sean Burke on the mound for the Sox tonight. He'll be opposed by Joey Cantillo, the lefty. So White Sox have had a lot of success against lefty pitchers, so hopefully they continue that tonight. And a quick scheduling note for White Sox broadcast tomorrow. Due to scheduling conflict with the Bears on ESPN 1000, tomorrow's game will be heard on WGN Radio AM 720 as the White Sox will wrap up their series against the Guardians. So again, tomorrow and a lot of Sundays in September when the Bears are playing, you can hear the White Sox on WGN AM 720, and that is again the case tomorrow. So 12:30 pregame on WGN, 1:10 first pitch for the series finale between the White Sox and Guardians. But of course, Today's Saturday, you're going to hear today's broadcast right here on the home of the White Sox, ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. All right, when we come back, Len Casper always joins Waddle and Sylvie on Fridays. Always a fun conversation. Lots regarding the White Sox, some things regarding baseball. We'll let you hear that conversation with Len Casper coming up right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back here live at Raitt Field on White Sox Weekly as we get set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Guardians. Len Casper will be on the broadcast tonight with Connor McKnight. And Len Casper joins Waddle and Sylvie every Friday here on the flagship station for White Sox baseball, ESPN 1000. And an interesting conversation was had, as it usually is on Fridays. Take a listen to Len with Waddle and Sylvie.
The bigger surprise over the last month, Colson Montgomery, who we just heard, who I believe should be in the running for comeback player of the year, because this is one of the truest comebacks I've ever seen, or Andrew Vaughn, who's doing what he's doing for the Milwaukee Brewers.
Wow. I probably would go with Vaughn just because of the sheer red hotness of it. Right?
Yes.
He can't be stopped. It's like every night. He had 2 more hits, 3 more RBIs. Oh, he hit another home run. So I would probably lean slightly toward Vaughn with it being very close, though.
I would probably go with Vaughn as well, but like, I mean, you're not eligible, right? I mean, it's a great sell, Sylvie, but like, you can't win that award because of something when that's happened in here. The middle of the year.
Right, Lane, we were just joking that can a rookie win comeback player of the year?
I suppose anybody could win it theoretically, but I would have a hard time. Well, let's put it this way. Let's say it's a rookie player who had gone through some physical ailment or had overcome some childhood disease or something. You could maybe make a case for comeback player of the year, but I think struggling in the minor leagues and then having success in the major leagues probably would not make you a candidate for that award.
Hey, Len, what do you think? Is fatigue an issue? You have so many young guys here, and I know that the minor league season is very, very long, but when you're at the big league level, the concentration factor, I would assume, is multiplied by X number of times. Is fatigue and making sure that all of these young guys are on the same page, is that something to keep an eye on? Because they've all played exceptionally well at different times, but it is a really long season, and the competition level is ridiculous.
Tom Waddle, you get the question of the day. Ding, ding, ding. It's a great, great question. The answer is yes. There's no question about it. Look at what happened at the end of the first half. 4 days off, and then all of a sudden the offense got red hot. I think all the younger players, even the veteran guys, probably just needed a breather. And I think the starting pitching innings are going to be watched. Shane Smith went on the IL right out of the break. And while it stinks to be out for 2 weeks, I think that's going to help him get to the end of the road in September. The minor league season now, the way it's configured, it goes to like mid-September as opposed to the early part of September, but it's not the same. The grind here at the major league level is a real thing. I think mental fatigue is as big a deal as physical fatigue when you're just doing this every single day. Yes, going through this is really hard, and I think it'll pay off in the end, even if there are some struggles in September down the stretch, because then guys know next year coming in, here's what I need to do to make sure I get through the year in one piece.
And Len, let me ask, with that as the backdrop, do you think that this organization is more well-equipped to handle that, whether it's your manager or it's the people in the dugout that are helping with him? Do you think the organizational structure is significantly better to help these young guys do that?
Well, I think because, and I wasn't here, you know, 7, 8 years ago when that first that wave of young players kind of came up together, you know, Eloy and Moncada, and then eventually Luis Robert Jr. and that group. But being here now with a lot of guys kind of in the same boat, I think is very helpful. And then I think the pitching infrastructure, which we often talk about, is very well equipped to handle the pitching staff as well. And I don't know if you guys were going to ask me about Gavin Williams, but I think it's a really fascinating topic and talked to a lot of people the last 2 days. So for listeners who are unaware, Gavin Williams went into the ninth inning with a no-hit bid for Cleveland the other day. He's 26 years old. It was his 55th major league start. So he's been here for parts of three seasons, still a young pitcher. He threw 126 pitches, and he gave up a home run with one out in the ninth to Juan Soto on pitch 117. Stephen Vogt did not have a reliever up in the Cleveland bullpen. He faced two more batters, and after walking, I believe, Brandon Nimmo, he finally took him out, and Hunter Gaddis got the final out. But you get such a disparate a region of, you know, answers from people in terms of, oh, I would never have let him come back out for the eighth. I wouldn't have let him come out for the ninth. Or, as Stephen Vogt said, I didn't talk to him and ask him how he's feeling. I didn't talk to the pitching coach to ask him what I should do. He was not coming out of that game. And I appreciate that Vogt was very black and white about it as opposed to kind of hemming and hawing. And we're all guessing is the point, right, yes. To get back to the first part of the conversation. Jacob Mizorowski got taken out recently, I think after 65 pitches and extra rest, and Gavin Williams goes 126. I don't think anybody knows what the right answer is, but most organizations are way more cautious than they've ever been.
I'm sure you guys talked about this on the broadcast. I know he didn't have a big Sox killer game yesterday, but a guy who used to be on the Guardians, Josh Naylor, just kills the White Sox, Len. And it was part of our chat group the other day, all the Sox fans weighing in. Meller's a part of that, obviously. And a lot of Sox fans would like to see the Sox get the Sox killer. Do you think that there's a fit there?
Well, I think that that's a position that in the offseason, I'm sure this front office will look at, and that is, you know, kind of a left-hand hitting, slugging first baseman, even though Naylor is not really a huge home run hitter, but he's always been clutch, as we know, against the White Sox. And DJ says Naylor hates the White Sox. I think it's more, does he love the White Sox, right?
Right, right.
I think he probably enjoys seeing when the White Sox come to town. And when he got traded to Seattle, my first thought was, oh, man, they've got to face him three more times. He, for me, even more than Jose Ramirez, since I've been here, has probably been the best hitter against the White Sox for sure. So, yeah, I mean, he'll be a free agent. I think he'll get a lot of interest around the league, and I think he's made Seattle a very intriguing dark horse AL pennant candidate.
Len, how about the season Cal Raleigh's having? You got to look at him up close and personal. That's pretty special, isn't it?
He's great, and he hasn't really been hitting much of late, but when he does hit, he hits home runs. And because Aaron Judge had missed some time, if you look at the rate stats, Judge is still kind of the king of the league. But I think if the season had ended today, I think Cal Raleigh is your American League MVP.
Wow. That's quite a season.
Behind the plate. I mean, offense, he's great behind the plate.
Is it because of Judge's injuries?
Yes, for me, it's the positional value of Raleigh. And without him, I don't think the Mariners would be where they are right now, which is in a pretty good spot as they're trailing the Astros in the AL West.
Len, are we anticipating any other young guys getting called up this season for the Sox?
Great question, Sylvie. I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine there might be a pitcher or two we could see before the end of the season. I don't know position player-wise that there's anybody right now on the radar, but I will point out the Birmingham Barons, the AA affiliate of the White Sox, have won 22 of their last 24 games.
Wow.
I don't know if I've ever been with a big league team that's had a stretch that good. So those guys are obviously having a great time. They're not hitting much because you don't hit much in that ballpark or in that league. But they're pitching great. They're playing defense. And it's been fun to see.
Len, any idea? Oh, I was going to say how long Mydroth will be out.
I don't know the answer to that. He could play defense. He just couldn't hit, and I think it just got to the point where they felt like, you know, we can't play short every day. So It'll at least be the 10 days, and I think it's just whenever he feels good again swinging the bat, he should be good to go. Because Vargas and Mydroth are out right now, it takes away some of your depth, and that may have affected, you know, the White Sox a little bit on this road trip. But they're going to get a look at Curtis Meade, who they got in the Adrian Hauser deal. He's playing first base, and Brooks Baldwin's getting some good reps and is taking advantage.
How about that? Len was on point there. Curtis Meade with a couple of RBIs last night, and Brooks Baldwin homered again despite the White Sox falling to the Guardians. Let's pause quickly, 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves. Sox fans, head to the ballpark on Saturday, August 23rd, as the White Sox take on the Twins at 6:10. The first 15,000 fans in attendance will receive a 1980s sweater vest presented by Rate. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, Vinny Duber of the Chicago Sun-Times in the house. He joins us next right here on White Sox Weekly.
Cap and Jay Hood, Monday morning at 7, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly live at Rate Field as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 between the White Sox and Guardians. Tigers come to town on Monday for a 3-game series as well as the White Sox are in the midst of a 6-game homestand. And as we are here at Rate Field, it's my pleasure to be joined by Vinny Duber, a longtime White Sox man. He's been locked in on them, of course, covers baseball for the Chicago Sun-Times these days. Vinny, great to see you. Thanks for joining us here in the booth.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
My pleasure, my man. All right, so White Sox right now in the midst of a 5-game losing streak, but I am encouraged basically by what we've seen since the start of the second half here after the All-Star break. I don't know how sustainable it is. I'm curious as to your thoughts, what you've seen from them as they are just crushing the ball. Obviously, the edict from the front office and Will's coaching staff is, hey, we have to do a better job of attacking the fastball and doing more damage. And they had apparently a meeting right after the start of, right after the All-Star break. And it seems like the players have taken that to heart. Do you think this is a product of just a small sample size, or do you think this is actually something that's sustainable?
I think it maybe can be a little bit of both, right?
Sure.
I mean, I think they exploded out of the second, out of the All-Star break there, and you saw the dividends pay off right away from what the front office and the coaching staff was doing. And I think that in itself is exciting for White Sox fans, who over the years, I know it's very difficult sometimes for fans to see what coaching does in the games, right? And so to have this very tangible thing, hey, they told him to do this, and boy, look, they're doing it.
Yeah.
That is an exciting thing for White Sox fans and probably can get them on board with Will Venable, who obviously is a first-year manager, and the staff, which is, you know, a little more experienced, but for taking these guys in the right direction. That being said, you know, they weren't gonna go out and win every series for the rest of the year. This is still a team that is on pace to have, you know, a very large number of losses by the time the season wraps up. So they were probably going to fall back down to earth, but seeing some of those very concrete examples of coaching, of implementing things that these guys want them to do, I think that is a very good sign of progress for what Chris Getz's rebuilding project is heading, which direction
yeah.
that's heading in.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's a great point. I'm curious, so, and you mentioned it, you know, they're 32 games under 500, so you have to, you know, temper expectations a little bit. Maybe sometimes I have to reel myself in. I find myself in post game, especially over the first 15 games out of the All-Star break, like, hey, what the hell's going on here? This is a tangible change that we're seeing, and, you know, to lead the league in home runs in the second half. Now that we're getting we're almost 20 games through, that's interesting. It's still a small sample size, but it's now starting to become a little bit more, you know, substantive when you look at it. So if they get through, I guess, what is, in your opinion, a realistic number of wins in the second half? Is like going 500 in the second half, is that like absurd to even say with a team that has been as bad as they were in the first half record-wise?
I don't know, maybe a little. I think the thing that you're seeing that would work in favor of something like that is what you're getting from young guys who are going to be here for a long time, right? And that's going to be the big takeaway no matter what the record ends up being. I think when we started the season, it was pretty obvious that the record really didn't matter, right? At the end of the day, it was going to be, are these young guys progressing? Is the core of this team progressing in a way that points to that brighter future and Chris Getz's work kind of bringing something about that he wants to come about, which is a contending White Sox team. And So to see that happening, even in this small sample size, is probably an extraordinary positive for the White Sox. But is it going to equal this, wild 2 months where everything goes right? That's a lot to ask. It's a lot to expect. But I think if you can go into next year as the White Sox really pointing to a lot of positions on the field where, hey, things went well there at the end of the season, you can expect to start talking about numbers next year, right? Maybe not. Maybe not in terms of competing for a championship or anything like that. That might be a little further off still. But in terms of, hey, how much better can this team be than it has been in seasons past?
No, it's a great point. Vinny Duber of the Chicago Sun-Times joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Jeff Meller, as we're getting set for game number 2 of 3 here at Rate Field. All right, so Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro. Interesting, they're continuing with the two catcher project, and I asked Connor earlier, is this something where you could realistically, I guess you've watched baseball for a long time, do you think, carrying two catchers where both guys are essentially quote unquote the starter, can you go forward in the future and have both guys maybe manning 80 games per year, and then I don't know if it'll be like 40 games at DH or what the plan is specifically, but do you think this is something that is actually workable in, this modern-day Major League Baseball?
I think the good news for the White Sox is they don't have to figure that out right now.
Sure.
Right? I think they've got two guys who are developing, who are obviously at the Major League level and getting their first tastes of the Major League level, and they can say, hey, we're going to put a smaller amount of stuff on your plate in terms of workload, right?
Yeah.
So you can learn everything that you have to learn. I mean, catcher is the most difficult position on the field because you got to be an expert on the pitching and you got to be an expert at the hitting. And it's why you don't see too many really good hitting catchers, of course. Then you look at the Major League home run leaderboard and the guy at the top of it is a catcher. But
he's a different animal.
It should tell you how impressive that is, what Cal Raleigh is doing, because it is a hard job. The White Sox have two guys who are just starting out, and so I think right now, in a rebuilding season, it's a benefit to have those guys sharing that workload, really. Now, you get to a point down the road where the White Sox are trying to put their best 9 guys on the field every night to try to win every night, to try to win a division and a playoff series and a championship. And that there might be a different answer to that question.
Sure.
I think it's probably going to be cross that bridge when they come to it, right?
Yeah.
And if, for example, I'm just picking one of the two, Caro ends up being the guy that you want behind the plate, Teal maybe fits in somewhere else into the puzzle, so both those guys can play as much as they can, because they definitely have been bright spots for this team this year. Success stories in terms of getting them up to the major leagues and seeing them have some success at the plate. So I think 2 years down the road, that question is going to be very different than it is in 2025.
Vinny Duber joining me here on White Sox Weekly. So somebody not in the lineup tonight, but he's been a revelation, I think, for a lot of White Sox fans. Might have been a little bit discouraged earlier in the year, and rightfully so. Colson Montgomery had to go, to Arizona to basically rework his swing with Ryan Fuller on a one-on-one basis. And now that he's come up to the majors, they've given him the torpedo bat, and all of a sudden he's taken off and excelled. 8 home runs here, in the last, 14 games. Now he didn't homer last night. So what have you thought from what you've seen from Colson Montgomery? And, the one thing I'll point out, even though the power has been there, the on-base percentage now dropped below 300. So he still has some work to do. But what have you seen from Colson Montgomery so far in about a little bit over a month?
I mean, personally,
yes,
I have been very surprised.
Me too.
I didn't think this was going to happen. I saw what Colson did the last 2 years in AAA, and I said, the major leagues is such a greater challenge. There's no way he steps up here and has success right away. It's been the opposite, right? He has been terrific. You mentioned, there's some things to work on, and he's the first time major leaguer. That should be no surprise. But the things that he was getting questioned about the most over the last few years as a minor leaguer, he has answered with, an exclamation point. That defense has been fantastic. And this is a guy who, the conversation around was, could he even be a shortstop at the major league level? The defense, is he going to be able to play defense? He's playing fantastic defense, not just at shortstop, but when they're putting him at third base too. To see him have success offensively after having very little as a AAA player for a year and a half, it's personally stunning, but also speaks to the talent that has always been there with Colson Montgomery. And I think The main thing that I've realized, I asked Chris Getz about this.
I was going to say it was your question, right? Because I want it before you set it up, but Vinny. But this is a great question by Vinny when we were in the media scrum with Chris Getz, just talking about like, hey man, sometimes you just trying to get to the majors so hard, right? That it feels overwhelming as a minor league player. But the reality is that sometimes you get to the major leagues and you can kind of just take a breath and everything doesn't feel like it's the end of the world if you don't necessarily have success.
Yeah, I mean, Colson told us last year that those struggles were getting to him. He told us that there were, you know, parts of the game that are mental and emotional that were problems for him because of the frustration of not having the success to get him to the major leagues. And then he goes out and has more of it this year, earlier this season. And I think you got to give a lot of credit to him for being open to, you know, being sent out to Arizona. Give a lot of credit to a new hire in Ryan Fuller, who is able to work with him to produce some of that success at AAA before he came up here. But I think the main thing is just, you're finally here.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry. Your job is no longer
to get here.
I have to get to the major leagues. It's I can go be a baseball player.
Absolutely.
And Chris Getz kind of confirmed that yesterday. It's something that I think has definitely been noticeable with him because he seems very comfortable here. And I think that you know, every player's development is different. And I think a lot of fans want to see, okay, he hits this batting average and he hits this many home runs. He's ready. Box checked. There are so many boxes that you can't find by looking on Baseball Reference or looking at a stat sheet. And, you know, Colson had a few of those.
Yeah.
And he's here, and getting here, I think, checked some of those boxes, just merely getting on the plane and coming to Chicago.
Yeah, and I will echo your point. He does not just on the field look and feel comfortable, but inside the clubhouse. You know, you see him every day. You know, his locker's next to Chase Mydroth. They look like they're, you know, a pair of gloves together. They certainly, you could very easily see, you know, based on what we've seen so far, again, a small sample size, but in their rookie year, those two could very easily be the middle infield, especially to your point about his defense has been kind of overwhelming. Like, wow, what a surprise for a lot of people because that was definitely an issue. Now, you know, just so because I don't want to, you know, people to accuse me of just, you know, giving bouquets to a team that is 32 games under 500. You know, for me, the alarming thing is what Andrew Vaughn has done in Milwaukee, right? The White Sox traded him for Aaron Civale, and man, like, I think White Sox fans, the fan base, if I had to poll them, majority would say they were happy to see him go. They, you know, he was a punching bag, maybe unfairly. But for whatever reason, sometimes just a change in scenery, a different organization, maybe that's what it was needed for Andrew Vaughn. And again, I will throw the caveat, small sample size. But I guess, should White Sox fans be concerned that Andrew Vaughn goes to Milwaukee and then all of a sudden the light has gone on for him?
No, I don't think they should be concerned. I mean, you mentioned it, the change of scenery. That can be a powerful thing in baseball. And I think you've seen throughout, you know, it probably happens over and over every year, if you're paying attention to the whole league, guys who will do that get moved from a situation in which they've kind of stagnated a little bit and go to a new home and kind of feel like they got something to prove, right? I mean, like I said, the mental and the emotional can be powerful, can be more powerful than the physical sometimes in this game. And I think you see a player in Vaughn who, you know, he always had it in him, right? There's a reason he was such a high draft pick, a reason he was such a well-regarded prospect. And you know, there was a reason White Sox fans are waiting for so long for him to come around. He's come around with a Brewers team that, you know, seemingly never loses. And maybe, you know, being in the middle of a winning situation is a big boost for him, too, because he rarely had that during his time here on the South Side. Listen, I mean, Andrew Vaughn was in the minor leagues when they made that trade. I mean, the White Sox gave him plenty of opportunity to get to that point. He didn't get there with them. They make the trade to hopefully get something out of Aaron Civale. It looks like at this point, as we've moved past the trade deadline, that's going to be innings relief maybe for the rest of their pitching staff. Kudos to Andrew Vaughn for figuring it out, even like you said, if this is a small sample size. But there's a lot of things, be it a change of scenery or a move to a winning team, a first-place team, a best-in-baseball team, I believe, the Brewers, that can really kind of make a flip switch for some players.
Yeah. Last thing I'll ask you, Vinny, and thanks again for your time. Follow him on X. He's at Vinny Duber. Does a great job covering baseball for the Chicago Sun-Times. Must read. So how about a bigger picture, but maybe you can apply it to the White Sox as well. Roman Anthony, Boston Red Sox, if you're not locked in on them, he was one of the top, I think he was the top prospect in baseball for a brief moment there. He has come up to the majors, and even though he hasn't necessarily hit for the power that most people expect he eventually will, he's done a really nice job on base percentage, close to 400. The Red Sox signed him to a massive extension this week, $130 million, taking him up to, I believe, his age 29 season with some escalators in there. So, you know, the White Sox have a lot of these young players that we've been talking about and are excited to see here at the major league level. And we've seen them do that in the previous era with Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams, where they would try and lock up younger players, Luis Robert Jr. being one of the primary examples. Do the White Sox have anybody on this roster that you think, and I don't think they'll get a Roman Anthony-sized deal, but who you think could be of that ilk, whether the White Sox are looking to sign them to a long-term deal?
I mean, I think there are some guys who could play their way into it. I don't know if there's anybody maybe who you would do that with today.
Yeah.
You mentioned what the White Sox did with Luis Robert Jr., Eloy Jimenez, both signed to a deal like that before they even played in the major leagues. Yoan Moncada, you know, was coming off a good year but wasn't far behind. Those three guys were best in baseball prospects.
They were.
And they were extraordinarily highly rated, and they were expected to be middle-of-the-lineup hitters and just have nothing but success. It didn't work out that way for those guys, but you know, the way that they were thought of at the time matched the want to get a contract like that done. You can say the same for Anthony in Boston. Colson Montgomery has been there as a prospect, but has not been there, is not there now, right? He has been there in the past few years, but after last year, he wasn't thought of as that at that level anymore. Could he play his way into that if we're having this conversation a year from now?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. They've got a couple left-handed pitchers down in the minor leagues who are thought to be prospects like that, right? And Noah Schultz, Hagen Smith. So it's possible, but I think as you're looking right now, you're looking for guys who maybe need to play their way to that status rather than own that status today, and it's we got to get this guy locked into the middle of our lineup for the foreseeable future.
No doubt. Well, great breakdown, and I think you know Schultz and Smith are good guys to bring up because, listen, Chris Sale and Jose Quintana, two guys who the White Sox did that with as well, getting them locked up to team-friendly deals. So it's certainly something that this organization has done in the past. Vinny Duber, great work. Appreciate you joining me here on White Sox Weekly.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Again, Vinny Duber, check him out at the Chicago Sun-Times. Does a great job breaking down all things baseball. Hey, students, it's easier than ever to get your friends together for a White Sox game. Sign up for a student pass alert and get exclusive access to lower-level ticket offers. Text STUDENT to 244-769 to sign up or visit whitesox.com/student for more information. We'll wrap up White Sox Weekly when we come back right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Recap the game. Cap and Jay Hood weekday mornings at 7.
Jeff Mettler back here on White Sox Weekly as we are wrapping this week's edition up, getting set for your pregame coverage, which will start at 5:30 between the White Sox and Guardians. First pitch coming your way at 6:10 this evening. Len Casper along with Connor McKnight, who will be in for DJ the next 2 days. As DJ taking this series off, he'll be back on Monday, but always a blast to have Connor in the booth with Len. So they will be up right around 6 o'clock, but as always, we'll have your pregame coverage starting at 5:30 tonight as the White Sox get set to take on the Guardians for game number 2 of 3 as they are in the midst of a 6-game homestand. Tigers come to town for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week. White Sox fans, there's still time to win a one-of-a-kind experience this season. Enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win a 2026 suite for a game. August's winner will receive a 20-person suite for a mutually agreed-upon game in 2026. Host your friends and family in luxury while cheering on the Sox. To visit visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. All right, so I do want to mention this historic day in baseball as Jen Powell became the first woman to umpire a regular season Major League game. She did so in the first game of the Atlanta Braves-Marlins doubleheader today. She was the extra ump for the doubleheader as the Braves and Marlins are in the midst of a 5-game series, and today was the doubleheader day, and Jen Powell made some history today, which is pretty cool, becoming the first Major League umpire as a woman in a game, regular season game. So pretty cool for that one earlier today. I did want to mention that. Also, do want to mention for all you White Sox diehards who never miss a game of action. Reminder that tomorrow's game, Sunday, will be taking place on WGN Radio because the Bears have their first preseason game against the Miami Dolphins. So ESPN 1000 will be carrying the Bears broadcast. We will be with you on WGN Radio AM 720 tomorrow afternoon. But tonight, you get White Sox baseball right here on ESPN 1000. That's going to do it for us. I want to say thank you to Connor McKnight and Vinny Duber and also Len Casper for being a participant. We replayed his interview with Waddle and Sylvie. So thank you to all those great guests. Thanks to Justin Pottinger and Brendan Riley as well. That's going to do it for this edition of White Sox Weekly. White Sox pregame show starts next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.